Today is Friday, June 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden has a productive meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
And renewed our commitment to defending the enduring democratic values that both our nations share.
Plus, previous crises exacerbate the humanitarian crisis in Tigray.
We had the desert locust this past year, hailstorms, some pockets of the region that are already chronically affected by drought.
And a look at the history of Alaska's Denali National Park. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden met with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson Thursday. Biden characterized the meeting as being productive.
We discharged and discussed a broad range of issues on which the United Kingdom and the United States are working in very close cooperation. We affirmed the special relationship, as is not said lightly, the special relationship between our people, and renewed our commitment to defending the enduring democratic values that both our nations share.
The president also said that the pair discussed the Atlantic Charter, the document signed by Prime Minister Winston Churchill and President Franklin Roosevelt 80 years ago that led to the creation of NATO.
Today, we build on that commitment with a revitalized Atlantic Charter, updated to reaffirm that promise while speaking directly to the key challenges of this century: cybersecurity, emerging technologies, global health, and climate change. We discussed our common goals for driving ambitious global action to address the climate crisis. And the Climate Leaders Summit that I hosted in April was in part about helping drive forward the momentum toward the critical COP26 that the UK will host in Glasgow later this year.
The withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan was another topic touched upon during their conversation, according to the president. Biden, Johnson, and the rest of the G7 leaders begin their summit on Friday. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is set to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden Monday on the sidelines of the upcoming NATO summit. Their discussions are seen as pivotal, given the strained relations between the two nations. Dorian Jones has this preview.
Among the most challenging tasks facing President Joe Biden during his stay in Europe will be his meeting next week with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. That's because bilateral relations are near breaking point, warn some analysts.
There have always been periods of troubles, you know, disagreements, divergences, etc. But what we are experiencing currently is probably the rock bottom, in the relations. So either the relations will recover at one point or they will break irreparably and irreversibly.
One point of tension, the U.S. expulsion of Turkey from its F-35 fighter jet program after Ankara purchased Russia's S-400 anti-aircraft missile system. Washington says the purchase undermines NATO defense systems. Turkey's relationship with Russia is one of many differences between the allies. Erdogan's crackdown on domestic dissent prompted Biden to call him an autocrat last year during the U.S. presidential election campaign. Biden is making the promotion of democracy worldwide a fundamental tenet of his foreign policy. Erdogan, too, has grievances. Washington is backing Syrian Kurdish forces who were instrumental in fighting the Islamic State. Forces that Turkey considers terrorists. But Ankara sees the Erdogan-Biden meeting as an opportunity for a reset, according to a presidential advisor.
I believe in Turkey's bag there will be key commitments that will open a new page in bilateral relations. Turkey is willing. But there is no room for dreams in real politics, only rationality. America is a pragmatic country. America should think what the cost is of losing Turkey.
In a bid to remind NATO of Turkey's importance, Erdogan said Turkish fighter jets will soon be sent to the Baltics in support of his allies as they face off against Russia. But a Reuters report quoted diplomats saying Turkey pushed NATO allies to water down NATO's condemnation of Belarus for intercepting a civilian plane. That was widely interpreted as a pro-Russian gesture. Erdogan insists Turkey can have good relations with both Moscow and the West. But the likely message from Biden to Erdogan, according to one analyst, is that he may have to choose between the two by giving up Turkey's Russian missiles.
Keeping both Americans and the Russians happy is not within the realm of possibility. So Erdogan is, unfortunately, is hard-pressed to make a very hard choice. It's time for him to make a hard choice. And I don't see if he can postpone such a crucial decision.
Yet Erdogan and his ministers have repeatedly said the Russian missiles will stay, calling it an issue of national sovereignty. Doreen Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
The United States and the European Union held a virtual roundtable event Thursday to discuss the ongoing humanitarian crisis that's unfolding in Ethiopia's Tigray region. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, gave the opening remarks, and I caught up with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, who told me the ambassador started off by saying that the international community cannot let Ethiopia starve.
We need to act now. And she was quite angry, actually, at her colleagues on the UN Security Council, because the council has been largely silent on the situation. They've had a handful of private meetings. They've put out a statement or two, but they haven't really applied the pressure that they have in their toolbox to kind of bring the fighting to a halt and let aid workers into the areas where they need to be and to do the things that need to be done to contain and reverse what's becoming a huge man-made disaster.
Margaret, prior to today's meeting, the World Food Program released a video. And in that video, Maria Santamaria, who is the World Food Program head of program and operations in English, who's in Mokele, said that what's going on in the region prior to the conflict has been affected by the shocks in recent years.
We had the desert locust this past year, hailstorms, some pockets of the region that are already chronically affected by drought. It means that this is an area that's already a bit on the edge. And so now with the conflict, the disruption of health systems, the collapse of markets in many areas, the inability to plant today because people don't have access to seeds, fertilizer, or the security to be able to plant, means that for WFP, the number one priority is going to continue to be that humanitarian assistance until the situation allows people to resume their livelihoods activities and meet their own food security needs.
So, Margaret, what kind of details can you share with our listeners about what was discussed in today's meeting?
Well, the current situation is shocking. There are 350,000 people in Tigray who are already in famine conditions, not slipping into famine, but there. And there are 2 million more people who are just a step away from that level of food insecurity. And then below them, there are even more people who are in an emergency state, but, you know, in one step behind them. So you have this index where they chart based on different variables how serious the situation is. But there are already 350,000 men, women, and children who are in famine conditions. And it's not just in Tigray. The humanitarians were clear about saying that there's also really serious situations going on in Afar and in Amhara and across Ethiopia, because as the World Food Program lady pointed out, because of the locusts and the drought and such, there are 16 million people who are in food insecurity situations across Ethiopia. So it's a major problem, not just from the conflict.
So moving forward, what kind of action items or next steps were discussed?
Well, there was a big call from both the humanitarian representatives and from the Western diplomats there for a humanitarian ceasefire to happen for Tigray so that aid workers can reach people in the most remote and hard to reach areas. And there was also a big call for money to scale up the operation. And the G7 group of nations are meeting right now in England. And so this meeting was sort of at the same time as that, I think, to highlight a bit. And President Biden has said the situation in Tigray will be on his agenda when he meets with his counterparts there. And there was definitely a call for the G7 to take action, to do something to prevent this getting worse. And there is a concern that by September, another 400,000 people could slip into these catastrophic famine conditions if there isn't immediate assistance.
Margaret Bashir is VOA's UN correspondent. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The United States has pledged to donate 500 million coronavirus vaccine doses to 92 countries in need through June of next year. But experts say Russia is working to discredit Western vaccines and aggressively marketing its own Sputnik V inoculation. Anoush Avitasain has the details.
By the time the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the use of the Pfizer vaccine to fight COVID-19 in December 2020, a Russian disinformation campaign was already underway, suggesting the vaccine was dangerous, even deadly. Russian media outlets and online postings pushed baseless claims of people dying after receiving the Pfizer jab, or that both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines caused blood clots. World Health Organization officials say these false claims by Russia are designed to undermine confidence in the vaccines being produced by the West.
What we call the infodemic is as big a problem as the pandemic. The infodemic is indeed this information that's being spread all around the world. It spreads more quickly than the virus itself.
But Russia is not alone in its disinformation campaign. The European External Action Service said in its latest report that both pro-Kremlin media outlets and China are working to undermine trust in European and U.S. vaccines. U.S. officials say they're doing what they can to fight back against the tide of disinformation.
We work with a wide variety of partners, from other governments to civil society organizations, to counter this. I think that, you know, particularly in the context of a global pandemic, where it's incredibly important to have people vaccinated, that there's a hunger for the truth. And thankfully, I think there's a growing number of organizations that are ensuring that people get it.
The result of all this disinformation is that it makes fighting the pandemic more difficult. Sowing mistrust in vaccines also harms Russia, say disinformation experts, by creating distrust among Russians themselves for the country's own Sputnik V vaccine. Anoush Avitasyan, VOA News, Washington.
A deadly second wave of the novel coronavirus has hit India's remote areas, many of which had not been affected by the first wave last year. Anjana Pasricha looks at the impact of the pandemic in the mountain villages in the northern state of Himachal Pradesh.
This local artist reenacts the threat posed by the coronavirus to residents in Himalayan villages if they do not follow COVID protocols. The innovative initiative to reinforce COVID protocols in Kangra district in India's Himachal Pradesh state was started as the second wave of the pandemic ravaged mountain hamlets that were untouched last year. It was accompanied with tougher steps. Police handed out penalties to those violating COVID norms. The measures came as many people contracted severe infections.
This time we got disproportionate number of cases when compared to our, you know, hospital infrastructure. So we had to raise the number of beds from 150 to almost close to 1500 now. And we had to raise the capacity of our ICU beds, ventilator beds.
With hospitals stretched, authorities asked hundreds of infected people to isolate at home. That was a challenge for those living in tiny dwellings. Resident Sudhir Sharma set up a facility for people to isolate after his driver tested positive.
He told me he would pitch a tent outside his home. It started from there because I understood that many people would be facing a similar predicament.
Meals were cooked for families who could not prepare their own food and kits of basic medicines given to the sick. Such civil society initiatives boosted efforts by village authorities as they distributed food rations to affected families and sent health workers to monitor their condition.
We go to homes and explain about the coronavirus. We tell them to keep up their spirits. The illness will pass.
Infections have plummeted in recent days. But amid forecasts that India will be hit with a third wave, authorities are ramping up isolation facilities. Campaigns to reinforce the need to follow COVID protocols will also continue. It is critical in a country where many had abandoned such measures.
Definitely, the second wave will teach a lot of lessons to everybody, and even to the government, to the system, and in fact, to the public at large. Had we been more careful and disciplined by way of, maintaining social distancing, wearing masks, etc., hand sanitization, hygiene, we could have prevented a lot of deaths and a lot of, active cases.
Residents say the devastation is heartbreaking.
Both young bachche.
So many young people in their 20s, in their 30s, they passed away. Every morning I got calls about people dying. I have never cried in my life, but I used to weep hearing such news.
The villages appear calm as the second wave ebbs, but nervousness still lurks along these Himalayan slopes. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
A new report finds 160 million children, or nearly 1 in 10, is involved in child labor globally. That's an increase of 8.4 million since 2016. A joint report by the International Labor Organization and the UN Children's Fund warns the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening an already alarming situation. The report is being launched in advance of the World Day Against Child Labor on June 12. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
This is the first increase recorded in absolute numbers since the International Labor Organization began tracking the extent of child labor globally 20 years ago. The data show nearly half of these children, or 79 million, are involved in hazardous work, 6.5 million more than in 2016. Hazardous work is considered as among the worst forms of child labor. It is dangerous, harmful to a child's physical and mental health, and could result in death. The ILO reports 70% of children work in agriculture, most on family farms, 20% in services, including domestic work, and 10% in industry. The picture that emerges from this study varies by region. The report finds child labor is continuing to decrease in Asia and the Pacific, as well as in Latin America and the Caribbean. However, child labor has risen substantially in Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says in Africa as a whole, 20 million more children are in child labor today than they were 4 years ago. Of those, he says 16.6 million are in Sub-Saharan Africa.
So if you look at that in percentage terms, it means that almost one in five African children are in child labor, one in four in the Sub-Saharan sub-region. They're losing out on their education. They're working at a young age, they're working too many hours, they are often working in hazardous occupations.
Executive Director of UNICEF, Henrietta Fore, expresses concern at the alarming rise in younger children who are toiling in child labor. She says half of all children in child labor around the world are aged 5 to 11 years. She says the COVID-19 pandemic is making this terrible situation even worse.
Faced with job losses and rising poverty, families are forced to make heartbreaking decisions. We estimate that 9 million more children could be pushed into child labor by the end of next year, a number that could rise as high as 46 million if social protection coverage falls victim to countries' austerity measures.
To reverse the upward trend in child labor, the ILO and UNICEF are calling for adequate social protection for all, including universal child benefits, and for quality education and increased spending in getting children back to school. They say decent work for adults must be promoted so children do not have to be sent out to work to help support their families. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A swarm of bug-tracking drones and tiny radars are being developed to help the conservation of rare insects in New Zealand. Phil Mercer explains.
The new tag-and-track technology is being developed at the University of Canterbury on New Zealand's South Island. Researchers hope it could lead to a deeper understanding of New Zealand's threatened and endangered insects. The research draws on years of experience in the area of bird conservation, where radio tracking methods have helped to protect many vulnerable species. Experts have said that, at a stretch, the technology could also be used to study large invertebrates, such as giant land snails, but was simply too big and heavy for most insects. Researchers have now made about 20 tiny so-called harmonic radar tags that are fitted to insects. They would then be tracked by a swarm of drones. Steve Pawson from the university's College of Engineering says bird tracking technology has been a major inspiration.
I've been doing radio tracking on many of these species over several decades now, and the information that they learn from that really informs the conservation management. So understanding how far do these things move, where do they go foraging, what are their foraging behaviours, even things as simple as how long things live for. Unfortunately, the radio tracking technologies that are out there at the moment are too heavy to use on small insects. There's only a handful of our heaviest insects that can carry those. And so we're really limited in our understanding of how invertebrates are moving through the environment. And if we have that knowledge, then we can incorporate it in our decision-making and our planning for conservation management operations.
Trials will start on ground-based insects before the New Zealand team tries to tackle the complexities of tracking insects in flight. Field testing could begin in 2023. Academics have said the study could also have applications in other disciplines, from biosecurity to medical imaging. Among New Zealand's endangered insects is the iconic weta. They're one of the South Pacific nation's most recognisable creatures, with their large bodies, spiny legs and curved tusks. Several species of weta are under threat from predation by birds and reptiles and habitat loss. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In this edition of This Week in Space, NASA sends squids to space, plus the world's wealthiest man makes out-of-this-world travel arrangements, and a soccer star talks game with an orbiting astronaut. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the details.
2-1-0. Ignition.
This week, from a launch pad at Florida's Cape Canaveral, private spaceflight company SpaceX launched its 22nd commercial resupply services mission to the International Space Station. The CRS-22 delivered more than 3,300 kilograms of cargo, including the first two new solar arrays to help power the ISS. Also on board CRS-22 were 128 newly hatched bobtail squid. Sea creatures in space are part of an experiment called Understanding Microgravity on Animal-Microbe Interactions, or UMAMI. The University of Florida's Jamie Foster explains why.
We all have microbes that are helping our bodies with our digestive system, with our immune systems. Microbes are essential for our health, animal health. And so what we don't really understand, the full mechanisms of communication, the dialogue that's happening between microbes and animal cells. And we know even less when we're in the space environment.
Foster says the project aims to understand how the stressors of space impact the healthy interactions between microbes and hosts. She says squid have similar immune systems to humans, but as they are simpler animals, researching their microbial interactions makes an easier model to understand the effects of space flight on more complex animals like humans. Which could be good news for the world's wealthiest human. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos announced this week his plans to join the first crew aboard his Blue Origin capsule.
You see the Earth from space, it changes you. It changes your relationship with this planet, with humanity. It's one Earth. I want to go on this flight because it's a thing I've wanted to do all my life. It's an adventure. It's a big deal for me.
It will likely also be a big deal for Bezos' brother and fireman, Mark Bezos, whom Jeff invited along for the 10-minute hop aboard the New Shepard suborbital vehicle. It will be the first time a capsule with crew flies attached to the New Shepard, and its flight date of July 20th falls on the anniversary of the 1969 Apollo 11 moon landing. And finally this week, a video call between French ESA astronaut Thomas Pesquet and French soccer superstar Kylian Mbappe. Pesquet, floating aboard the ISS, compared the flight to space to a roller coaster ride with 10,000 times the power. He also complained to Mbappe about the difficulties of playing soccer in space, saying the ball goes up but never goes down. Mbappe will soon be playing soccer on Earth at the pandemic-delayed European Football Championships. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
My name is Eric Johnson, and I'm a historian at Denali National Park. Beginning in the 20th century, scientists that had been coming to the region in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and exploring, and the Boone and Crockett Club, which was famously founded by Teddy Roosevelt and George Bird Grinnell. You know, it was basically a club of naturalists and hunters and outdoorsmen, and they really had a, I guess you'd say, an agenda to set aside national park lands, and they were very involved in early park establishments all across the Western United States. But one of their members, Charles Sheldon, came up to, well, into Alaska to study doll sheep. And he ended up in what is the now Denali National Park, but he's in the Denali region. And this is in 1906, was his first trip up here. And he explored the region and was studying the sheep. And he ended up coming back again a second time in 1907, 1908, and wintering here. And during that time, he, you know, he grew an appreciation for the park, for the scenic beauty, but also for the wildlife that he was seeing. And he understood what happened in the West, in the lower 48, regarding industrial development and railroad building, and what that meant for wildlife populations down there. And he was concerned. So he was concerned about the wildlife populations of interior Alaska, and he knew that they were special, the grizzly bears, the doll sheep, the caribou. And so after he spent some time studying doll sheep and sending specimens back east to Smithsonian, and he went back to New York and sort of pitched this idea of a national park in the Denali area. And interesting, he actually wanted to call it Denali National Park, even though by that time, most people were calling the mountain Mount McKinley, at least outsiders. Denali is vast. It's nearly 6 million acres, and it's oftentimes that actually may be the case. But there is another human story that sometimes gets forgotten, and this may just be me speaking as a historian, but there were people that lived here before the national park was established, and the mining that was going on in the area, there were other explorers, prospectors, but the Alaska Natives have been there for thousands of years. And what's kind of interesting is we actually have archaeology sites in the park that date back thousands of years. And I think there's this, as I said, there's this misconception that Alaska is the last frontier. I mean, it's not our license plate, you know, and it really is the last frontier for Euro-American exploration. But as far as other people's histories, the park itself has been home to humans and to subsistence living for thousands and thousands of years. So the human history goes way, 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 way back. And I think sometimes that gets forgotten. I know the mountain sort of gets a lot of the attention, but the whole Alaska range is just very scenic. And there's a good chance you're going to see a ton of wildlife, a moose, maybe a bear, if you're lucky. Several bears, a doll sheep. If you're even luckier, you'll see a wolf, but that's pretty rare these days.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.